like the whole class, going over a little bit of the physics that we've used but glossed over, just to make sure we're all on the same page. And there are approximations in useful pieces of physics that are used over and over and over again. So I'm going to talk about them from the point of view of the particular experiment we're looking at, but you will see them everywhere. So the first piece is effectively the rotating wave approximation. The rotating wave approximation comes up when you have two components of your Hamiltonian and they have vastly different frequencies. And you say, well, okay, if I want to see the dynamics, I could integrate over the whole bloody thing. But we're almost always interested in what the dynamics of the slow process are. And if I'm just doing a brute force integration, then I, of course, have to respect the timing of the fast dynamics, right? Because if I have two terms in the Hamiltonian, there's going to be some non-commutivity. The non-commutivity is going to drive the dynamics. And so if I don't sample finely enough, we're not going to get the right answer. Now, it's not such a big deal today with computers, right? You can do a very fine sampling in modest Hilbert spaces and see what you want. But you lose some of the insight in the process. And so partially the rotating wave approximation is to get insight, partially it's to allow you to have a back of the envelope calculation that will be correct. And then we'll see that of course we can quantify exactly the level of approximation we're making. So let's take an example again from SU2. So we'll take a Hamiltonian. So it looks like the Zeeman interaction, but it's just a Hamiltonian. It says let's define an energy for a spin 1/2 particle. It says that the quantization axis is about the z direction. And then I'm going to apply a time-dependent field to this. And the time dependence I want to apply should do it correctly. Is an oscillating magnetic field, an oscillating field. And so what you're going to imagine here is that you have some strong interaction about the z direction and some oscillatory motion about the x direction and oscillating field in this case. And notice that I haven't made omega t equal to omega naught. So what we're going to assume is that omega naught is much, much greater than omega 1, and it's approximately equal to omega 2. Okay, so that's a useful, you'll see why that's a useful area that we're looking at. So in the magnetic resonance world, or the spin, what we looked at yesterday with the spin rotation, what we have is some field, so it's the picture for a field. Of course, omega naught is equal to gamma, the gyromagnetic ratio, times B naught. And we would have a coil here that is connected to a synthesizer. And the synthesizer would be set to this frequency omega T. So T stands for transmitter. And the synthesizer is just going to generate a sinusoid that drives the coil. And of course, the reason that we have an oscillating field is we're driving a field in a coil. Okay. Nothing surprising. And of course, again, have Schrodinger's equation. So we can look at the evolution of this. And of course, let me write it down explicitly, that rho is equal to u of t rho u t inverse, right? The solution to Schrodinger's equation.
Yeah. The h in Schrodinger's equation, is that the program we're talking
about? Yes, absolutely. So thank you. I'll put a zero there. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to go into an interaction frame to study these dynamics. And, you know, I have a lot of choices of interaction frames. But the one we're going to choose is the interaction frame associated with our choice of the experiment. So omega t, you know, this is a piece of electronics. We can dial up that frequency. So that's the convenient interaction frame. And often what we'll have is a series of different frequencies here. So nature will give us a range of frequencies. You know, we saw that in the neutron case, that there was a variation potentially of the magnetic field. So there isn't necessarily a unique frequency here, but since this one comes from our electronics, that's unique. That's a good place to go. So that's what we'll do. Now, the first piece, of course, is to take this Hamiltonian, and we're going to rewrite it as a sum of rotating and counter-rotating fields. Okay, just put the same term in each of those, right? And so we have one field that rotates, one field that counter-rotates, and of course, if I went over here to this picture, right? We started off with an oscillating field, and now I'm going to decompose it into two fields that are rotating in opposite direction. Because they're perfectly rotating in opposite direction, of course, the resultant field is, again, the oscillating field. So we haven't made any approximations. Yeah? This is all true. Okay. Then it's relatively trivial from here. We say, okay, I want to define an interaction frame in terms of this operator. I want to remove that operator. So we'll define an interaction frame that looks like, so use of I, the propagator that takes us into the interaction frame, is a function of time. It's equal to e to the minus I omega t, t over 2 sigma z. Okay? So now I've said, well, what's the interaction frame I want to go to? And that's pretty clear here, right? It says that I want to go into an interaction frame that lives with one of these terms. So I'm simply going to rotate the reference frame at that frequency. Okay. And then we'll define the density matrix in the interaction frame as ui of t rho u sub I of t inverse. Yeah? And then I'll take d rho tilde dt is equal to Yeah, so now then we've just expanded out the derivative for this. And, you know, the nice thing here, of course, is that U of t we know, right? The derivative of the density matrix we know, right? That's just the given by Schrodinger's equation, right? And it's nicest, actually, if I the hell did I write there? It's given by Schrodinger's equation. So I say it correctly, but I write something random. But we can write the right thing. The time derivative of the unitary, of course, just returns the Hamiltonian of the system. Right? So this piece is minus I h sub I u sub I inverse. And that was negative, so that's positive. And of course, we'll define here h sub I. That's just the log of this, right? So this is just going to be omega t over 2 sigma z. Yeah? And here we get the same thing, only this time with the negative sign. And you don't need to, the Hamiltonian and the unitary commute, so I don't need to worry about the ordering here. Yeah? And so I can take these two terms, and this is maybe a little bit too much detail. So now I can say, oh yes, I have a term that's u sub I t rho u sub I of t inverse h sub I. And this is plus I over here. Yeah, and then this term here, we have minus I h sub I u sub I rho u sub I inverse. And then we have, you know, this nice term u sub I of t minus I h rho u sub I inverse. Well, that's just rho tilde. So life is good. This is just rho tilde. So life is good. Here, I'm going to define one more term. We'll say that h tilde is equal to the interaction frame representation of the total Hamiltonian. Okay, so h is the sum of those two, h0 and h1. Okay, so we have this piece right there. And so we can rewrite this as minus I h tilde rho tilde. And now we find the final nice result. That the evolution of the density matrix in the interaction frame evolves as the total Hamiltonian in the interaction frame minus the Hamiltonian that took you to that interaction frame. Okay, so it all makes sense at the end. And of course, so far there's no approximations. This is always true. Yeah? And this piece is incredibly useful to to figure out where you want to be in an interaction frame. So what's that? Is the sign okay? It must, okay, let me put it this way. The signs in this equation are correct. And here we have this right, and then do I have it right here? No. Somewhere there's a sign error up there. So I'll leave it to you to find. I took my quantum mechanics from Les Foldy, who was a famous physicist you've never heard of. And he would start at the far end of the board, and he would get to the middle, and he would make a sign error. And that would be the end of the class. He would then spend the rest of the class going back and trying to figure out where he had made it. And so we had a rule in the class that you were not allowed, we don't have that rule here, that you were not allowed to say that there was a sign error. We'd all get together afterwards in a coffee shop and go and correct the notes. You can do that part of it. It's a good exercise to get together and correct the notes. But I'll just admit I have sign errors, and you can sort them out. Okay, so let's look at what happens here. When I take the total Hamiltonian and I go into the interaction frame, well, what do I see? Well, the total Hamiltonian's up here. When I take this into the interaction frame, well, the interaction frame is a Z rotation. It commutes with that part of the Hamiltonian, so nothing changes, right? And so if we said, oh, okay, H in the interaction frame is still omega naught over 2 sigma z. When I look at these terms, this one becomes time independent, right? That when I apply u here, then I get the identity on both sides. And so that term, plus omega 1 over 2 sigma x, we're really happy now because we're getting something time independent. Something time independent even I can integrate. And then I look at this term, right? And this term is going to pick up additional time dependence, right? So I'm going to multiply by 2. And so I'll get the term that looks like e to the I, I'll try to get the sign right this time, omega t times t sigma z sigma x e to the minus I, e to the plus I, omega t of t sigma z, right? So this becomes, in the language that we use, doubly rotating. Rotates twice as fast. And I need to subtract off the Hamiltonian that took me into the interaction frame, which is the one that I chose here, minus omega t over 2, minus, sigma z. Okay, so now we get the nice term that says, well, h tilde is equal to omega naught minus omega t over 2 sigma z plus omega 1 over 2 sigma x plus this term. But the rotating wave approximation says, take the DC part of this, okay? And so it says, instead of having it like this, I'm going to define an effective field. So H effective is equal to H tilde bar, the time independent part of this. And so this is equal to H effective. Yeah. And so this, of course, is an approximation. This is the approximation. By taking the time-independent piece of this, yeah.
And that way of rewriting the H1,
yeah.
Is it like exponentially in one side it's positive and the other one it's negative?
Yeah.
When we multiply the matrices, like Will they cancel?
So when I multiply this one, it'll cancel here.
No,
you mean just here?
Just like rewrite from the cosine?
No. Okay. I'm glad you asked the question. These two don't commute. So then when I multiply this together, then what I'll see is a rotation. Okay? And so if I say, if I take u of t, then what I'll end up with is, I nicely want to show this. You will show me. We'll do it very generally. You will show this to me. We'll add it to your homework assignment. Take e to the I omega t over 2 t sigma z, and just write out the power expansion of that. Okay, just expand it in powers, and show me that you will get a term that looks like cosine omega t over 2 t identity. And I do not promise about the sign, but you will get the sign correct, like so, sigma z.
The exponential just becomes diagonal.
No, that's correct. I mean, yeah, and
it is correct.
Yeah, you can work that out. Just find it faster.
Yeah. Yeah. So just write out the power series and have a look. Okay? And then, of course, the inverse will show up as a negative sign here if this is the positive sign. Yeah? But that's it's a good thing to concretely go through. So if you haven't seen it before, concretely go through it. Okay. So then, let's look at this dynamics here, that as we allow the system to evolve, we say, okay, this frequency, remember that what you said, that omega naught is big compared to omega 1, and these two are close. So at the end of the day, this frequency, just call it delta omega, it's going to be small compared to omega 1. And so now then I'll say that I have a field along z given by some delta omega, and I'll have a field along x given by omega 1, and of course the effective field is sitting out here. Yeah, and as I, if we were looking at the experiment that we were looking at before, where omega naught was varying, then of course this contribution would vary, and we would get a set of effective fields. Okay, and you know all the trivial things, right? That omega effective is equal to the square root of delta omega squared plus omega 1 squared, etc. Yeah. So by going off resonance, you speed things up. Yeah, by having this non-zero. And remember that what we were talking about last time, we said that if we wanted to have the neutron spin processing from plus z to minus z, then there was only one condition where that would hold. And that we can see here, that if I want to carry a state from here to here, and I'm rotating about some effective field, then that effective field uniquely has to be in the xy plane. Okay? Otherwise, we're just rotating in a cone about there and would never reach that field. Yeah? All right. All of that is simple.
Show us
what's under that second board?
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I kind of missed you last. Yeah, thanks.
Yep. Okay, so this is the zeroth level approximation, and now in and mostly it works really well, but of course it is only an approximation. We need to look further, and at this point, normally what we would do is talk about second order perturbation theory. I'm going to give you a solution for second-order perturbation theory, which we'll forget about all the formalism and just say, how do you directly get the result of second-order perturbation theory? So if I'm over here, then I would say, well, I could have taken u of t is equal to e to the minus I, the integral of h of t prime dt prime from 0 to t. And I would put in a cheesy operator called the Dyson time ordering operator, which says, it's like your mother. It says, get it right. And, you know, I don't know why we should have an operator in this particular case that says, you know, get it right. In this particular case, you should get it right. The rest of physics, we don't put the operator in there. You're free to get it wrong. But here, Dyson says we should get the ordering right. And of course, what he's saying is that the order you integrate the Hamiltonians matter because the Hamiltonian is time dependent and therefore doesn't commute with each other, with itself in time, right? So that's all the Dyson time ordering. Now this, okay, so there's the answer. We can always do it this way. We'll get the right answer, provided we're careful enough. What we'd like to do is to say, can't I replace this with an effective Hamiltonian? Okay, now I'm using the word effective differently here, so I'm going to call this an average Hamiltonian. So it says, imagine that I had a time-independent Hamiltonian driving the system, and I require that time-independent Hamiltonian, that it would take me to the same place I would have got with this time-dependent term. And for any value of time, I can certainly define this, right? But this average Hamiltonian is going to be different for every value of t that I look at, okay? And then we go and look at, well, how can we define this Hamiltonian? So we're going to take this average Hamiltonian of time, and I'm going to expand it into a sum of terms. Okay, yeah.
Is that a function of time?
It is not a function of time. Let me be careful here. We picture this average Hamiltonian as being applied time independently for that, right? It is the effective time independent Hamiltonian that would take me through this, that would create this action. However, for every value t, there is a different value of that. And so in that sense, I don't want to put it as a function of time. I'll put it as a subscript, right? For every value of time, there's a different average Hamiltonian.
So over there should be a subscript.
Oh, thank you. I should pay attention. Yes, thanks. Right. So it says for every value of time, there is a subscript. And I can do the same thing here. Yeah. Good. Okay, now you know that that if you look at the evolution of a system, that what you will see is
I don't even need to do that.
If I have H and it doesn't commute with each other, then we need to take into account the non-commutivity. So H T of 0 is just the average of the Hamiltonian. Okay, and that's what we calculated up here, right? We said that we went into, in this case, an interaction frame. So I'll put an interaction frame there for my fun. We'll just take the average over some time. Okay? The first order correction of this is a factor of I there. And now I have to make sure, actually, it's T1, T2, like so. It's just the integral of the non-commutivity of, again, this toggling frame interaction. And you can keep going down in terms, and of course what you'll add is you'll keep adding further and further commutators. And I'm assuming that you've taken and looked at two commutators that don't commute and calculated the first order correction for those in the past. So if I gave you e to the ia times e to the ib and I told you that they didn't commute and asked you what is
BCH?
It is a BCH expansion, yeah.
I missed something probably. The h tilde is the
interaction frame.
Total
Hamiltonian interaction frame. Yeah. You can, of course, apply average Hamiltonian theory in any frame. You can apply these. You know, it doesn't make any difference what the frame is. And I could take an interaction frame set of unitaries, sandwich this, and carry it through. So any place you want. It's useful to think about it in the interaction frame. And the reason it's useful to think about it in the interaction frame is if I'm going to integrate over a process, then I would like to integrate over one cycle of the process. So let's look here at our solution up here. If I'm going to integrate and I want this to go to 0, then I'm either going to integrate for a short time, I'm going to make that time periodic, one of the periods of omega t. Or I'm going to integrate over a very long time and choose a time randomly and know that it's going to go as 1 over the number of cycles, that the error is going to go as 1 over the number of cycles. Right? But it's much nicer just to integrate over a very short time and get the time right. So to apply these ideas numerically effectively, then you need to choose a time where you expect the time-dependent pieces to go to 0. Yeah? And so often we'll have a case, it's almost always the case anyways, that H total is periodic. Right? And so then since it's periodically, I know what the time is I want to apply. The time that I want to integrate over is exactly that cycle time. Yeah?
Where does the I come from to the first order interaction? Does it make the exponent real?
Yes. It gives us a proper Hamiltonian. And if you go through and look at the BCS theory, you get the same factor of I.
Because
you, of course, you have a commutator, right? Yeah. So it all fits in nicely. Okay. Now then, we go back to the same problem that we had. here, and we ask, how important is this doubly rotating term? Okay, so now we've taken the rotating wave approximation. We see that we get really nice dynamics. This is a piece of cake. But this term we did drop, and we say, okay, now let's go and have a look at what that term is going to look like. And you know, you can see what's going to happen here is that sigma x is going to be rotated into sigma y by this, right? And so if I look at the effective operator here as a function of time, it will go from sigma x to sigma y, etc. And so clearly, h does not commute with itself at all times. And it's an easy enough thing to integrate. I do, in this case, give you an old notebook with the integral explicitly calculated for it. Now, before you look there, if I tell you, or you see for yourself, that this doubly rotating frame is going to rotate from x to y, then if I ask you, well, what is the first order correction term going to look like in the effective Hamiltonian, you're all going to tell me sigma z, right? A resounding yes would be reassuring. Okay? So yes, that the first order term H1 has to be proportional to sigma z. And it's going to come in as omega 1 squared over this foolish factor 8 omega t. So omega t, remember, it comes in because we're sampling with we went into an interaction frame defined by that. So the omega t comes in because the tau time is going to be 1 over omega t. Omega 1 squared, of course, because we have the Hamiltonian twice. Sigma z, because that's the non-commutivity of the term. Okay, so then, very compactly, we can get some insights into the problem. We say that, yes, we know what the correction term is. It's going to be to shift the energy, right? We went into an interaction frame, and the fact that we have this other field there that's way off resonance is going to shift the energy of the spins, and it's going to shift the energy by this small amount. And it's small, right? Typically, this is of order 1. Okay, so and that's in frequency units, so 1 hertz, compared to this is about 10 to the 8th hertz. So easily seen, but a small term. Yeah? Now, let's come back to the effective field picture, which I lost somewhere on the board. But I can put it back up if I find what I do with the eraser. There it is. All right. So remember our effective field picture. It said that we had a term, sigma x, here. And we had an effective term, delta omega, along the z-axis. And that the spins were going to precess about this effective field. Well, I could take the effective field for the counter-rotating term, right? For the counter-rotating term, delta omega is huge, right? It's essentially twice omega naught. right? And so I could say, oh yeah, what I'm really looking at with this is that I have a term that is here, 1z twice omega naught. And I have a term here, which is omega 1. And instead of the spins precessing about this axis, they're precessing about this axis. And if you calculate the change in energy, it's exactly the same. Yeah? So this all, it all works out to the same picture. So in this particular case, everything is so simple that you, in fact, you don't even need perturbation theory. You can solve it exactly. And nicely, you'll find that every 5 years, somebody publishes that result again. So you have lots of opportunities to find that result. Yeah?
So just kind of make sure that I understand what's happening. You first introduced what the rotating wave approximation is.
Yep.
Then going to the Magnus expansion, you justified that approximation. That picture is, if we were not to go to the Magnus expansion and treated the doubly rotating frame, then what would have happened? You would have gotten the same result.
That's exactly right. Except now in your tutorial, you'll have to explain the doubly rotating frame is. But the rest of it is exactly right. I mean, here, I don't prove that this is easy to prove. Just like the BCS theory is easy to write down, this is very easy to prove. And it's a more useful approach to second order perturbation theory than the standard formulations of second order perturbation theory. You know, a lot of quantum mechanics is developed so that you can write things down and get an approximation usefully. But today, everyone's going to do everything on a computer anyways. So why, even if you want to do your analytics, you're going to do your analytics on the computer. So why not just do the calculation? Now, let's look at absolutely.
You leave the total evolution operator, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is always true. It's just a real drag to calculate. But this is always true.
Okay. And so why is it that when we are doing the expansion to see what's our average Hamiltonian, why are we using that modified Hamiltonian?
So the modified Hamiltonian, the interaction frame Hamiltonian, is a correct and complete picture of the dynamics. Okay, the only thing I did to get the interaction frame Hamiltonian was to go into a frame of reference unitarily. I didn't drop any terms. Okay? So the reason that I want to use the interaction frame representation here is that it gives me an easy definition of the time that I should be averaging over. I want to average here over a time that is that respects the periodicity of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so I make it explicit that I have one periodicity. Now, clearly, I could have taken this description of the Hamiltonian and I could have integrated with respect to this time. I would have gotten exactly the same, except now when doing that, I would have to keep the time dependent. I would have to sample finally compared to this term, omega naught, right? Over here, I only have to sample finally compared to a term delta omega. So it's much, much easier to do the integral, right? I still have to do an integral that's going to have, that's going to allow me to see what happens with the small frequency omega 1. Okay, but I don't have to integrate the rapid dynamics. Let's look at what happens here. Let's say that I'm on resonance. It's the nicest case. So if I'm in the laboratory frame, so this says I have H total, and I'll take delta omega to equal zero, okay? And let's start with rho equal to just a projection along the plus C axis, okay? So then we have X and Y. We start off with our state here on the Bloch sphere. And now, as a system evolves under this Hamiltonian, it will evolve in a motion like that. So it's going to have the piece that says, yes, you're rotating about sigma z, and right perfectly in phase, right? This is equal to omega, right perfectly in phase. We're going to rotate also about x. Okay, and the fact that they're perfectly in phase says that we have this nice spherical rotation. We get down eventually to the xy plane perfectly. And then I go to the rotating frame. And to go to the rotating frame, I'm going to rotate about the z-axis at a frequency of omega naught. Okay, so now I'm just taking this and rotating about the z-axis. So I have x and y in the rotating frame, and z is the same z. We start off at the same place. We give a rotation about the x-axis, and it simply rotates here. Right, and those are two complete descriptions of exactly the same dynamics. And, you know, this one's a little bit easier to deal with, and so we do that. It's not that the other one is so complex we can't deal with it, but this is a pretty simple example. Yeah? Okay, so now let me give you a more complicated example. Run out of boards. We saw in the last class that we wanted to have a neutron spin that was rotated from plus E to minus E. And one of the ways we did that was to have an adiabatic transfer. And so I wanted to do the same adiabatic transfer here. So we were going to start with our spins along Z. And it turns out that changing a strong magnetic field is a drag. So if you go into my lab and you look at the strong magnetic fields, they have inductances of 60 Henry. And so if I wanted to rotate those, well, it takes me a day, right? 60 Henry, the time constant, life is a drag. So we're not going to do that. So instead, we're going to rotate the effective field. So what I want to do is to take an effective field. And the effective field is exactly this Hamiltonian, but of course, I've got sigma x term here, right? So that's omega 1 sigma x. And on this axis, we have delta omega. And I'm going to change delta omega so that over time, I take the effective field from being along the positive z-axis all the way to being along the negative z-axis. Now, of course, I never get quite to the z-axis, right? If I wanted to be at the z-axis, then omega 1 would have to be 0, right? And so there's a small angle here, but we can make that angle pretty small. And then we can sweep through here, and we can calculate what happens as we change that sweep and what's the probability that we end up in the minus z state at the end of this. Okay? So now then you need to think, how many interaction frames do you want to go into? Right? So I have the first dynamic is that I'm changing the effective field direction. So I could say, oh yes, I have the effective field. So we'll just put that down as H effective. And this is a function of theta. But let's just leave it to say that, I'm going to rotate the effective field about the y-axis. So I'm going to change it by phi about sigma y. Now, I have to be a little bit careful, and you'll be a little bit careful, because, of course, the length of this changes, right? But this is the first effective field that I want to go into. I want to say that, yes, I can look at the dynamics in this piece. And then here, well, now then I have H effective. So here I have a term that is omega 1 over 2 sigma x e to the I, it's omega effective. E to the what do you have? Think about this. I don't need that. I could just look at my notes, but here we're saying that we have omega effective sigma x, right? I'm going to use this as the next. And sigma x, I better put an x prime there, right? Because this is saying that that is that axis, right? That's the rotation that I'm rotating about. And omega effective is equal to the square root of omega 1 squared plus delta omega squared, right? But this is the piece that's big, yeah? So this is the next effective field that I want to go into. So when you look at this dynamics, you say, oh, yeah, first I can take my spins and project into this because I only want the DC part, I only want the time-independent part. And then I can say, well, I'm going to move it around here. And as I'm moving it around here, I'm rotating it by this piece. I'm always just keeping the DC component as I rotate. Yeah? All right. So in this notebook, I do this calculation for you. And here is the result of the adiabatic sweep. So this is the Z component, and this would be the Y component, and this is the X component. The X component is shifted, right? Because if you look at that, the initial fields don't line up, right? The effective field isn't along Z, so there's actually a positive piece here. And as I sweep through this piece, then we see that yes, as the effective field comes in, you know, I'm only changing delta omega by constant steps. So as I change delta omega, we're still pretty high angles. When we get close, it changes quickly. That's actually a problem for adiabaticity. If I wanted to be more careful, I would do this slower. And then we end up pretty close to the minus z axis. In this case, I included the relaxation times T1 and T2. So that's why this decays a little bit, right? Because eventually it has to decay back up to here. And you see all of this high-frequency dynamics. And yet, if you went through with the rotating wave approximation in exactly the way I described, what you would see is just a single sigmoidal curve. Okay? And you would say, oh, but I've lost all this rich structure. But this rich structure is exquisitely dependent on exactly each of those frequencies. And so every time you would do the experiment, you would get some other wonderful rich structure that if you averaged over, it would go to zero. Or this is going to go to a little negative number. This will go to zero. Yeah? So this piece, in fact, experimentally isn't very interesting. This piece is. Okay? And by focusing your attention on the right interaction frame and then removing the high-frequency dependencies that you have there, you can just get the transformation that you want to see. That's a rewarding exercise to go through. Maybe a little much, actually, for a tutorial problem. Yeah. But, you know, if someone feels motivated, don't let it get in your way. All right. There was one more piece that I want to talk about for tomorrow. But actually, let me save it. Let me not try to do something in 4 minutes quickly. Okay, so this is the story of interaction frames, rotating waves, and the Magnus expansion. Also called the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formalism, and which was also invented. It was also worked out by Wilcox. So if you're in astrophysics, you'd relate it to Trotter's equation. And in fact, each of these correction terms is associated with a name. So I don't know. For something that you could solve as a homework assignment, I'm not sure how many people we have to associate with it, but there it is. And the overall piece says, look at your Hamiltonian. Take the simplest high-frequency term and remove it. And then go into that reference frame and take the DC piece. Okay? And then look at what happens to the time dependence of the non-commutivity that took you into the interaction frame. And what it's going to do is it's going to tell you that you're in the wrong interaction frame. You need to move over in your interaction frame, right? The fact that this came out as a correction term of Z in the effective field was in the ZX plane. Right? This changes the direction of your effective field. Okay? So then you go back into that corrected effective field. And then you do the same thing again and again and again. Yeah? Yeah?
So in this picture, we are changing omega t. And
that's right.
And omega naught was 400, I guess. Yes. Or was it?
Damn if I know. But I can find that. It's up here. Okay, so omega naught was 10 to the frequencies 10 to the 5, so 10 kilohertz. They were varying that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
and this is the RF frequency here. So the.
So it was a. Yeah. Is the difference is delta omega there?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's time.
Oh, time. Okay. I see. Right?
Right? Because what I'm doing. Geez, yeah. I should have said that. I'm sorry. What I'm doing is I'm sweeping the effective field.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm sweeping it in this way where the projection along Z is being systematically changed. And so the vector actually reduces and then it increases. Yeah? And that's what you see. And of course, as that vector becomes closer and closer to the Z axis, everything gets compacted. Thanks for the question. Okay. So next class, what we'll do is we'll start to look at Diamond NV centers as a way of looking at a system that has a small Hilbert space and a nice way of preparing and reading out the Hilbert space in terms of optics. And I'll have to look at another effective field picture to describe what happens in the NV centers is we have 6 electrons, but they exchange information with each other very quickly. And so it turns out that it appears that we have one electron that is a spin 1 particle. And so we'll go through and see how that works.
So we are coming
to
2.5 today?
Perfect.
question?
Yeah.
Is it okay when you get unitary transformation, remember there's going to be two guys here? Yeah, it shouldn't be like you inverse and you on the other side, so that because the row is rotating with everything, and we want to cancel the rotation of the H1.
So I need to choose one of these, and I just chose random. But I like the logic, so I'll say yes.
Well,
okay, but in fact, it all comes out the same.
Yeah.